being deprived of practically all means of making a livelihood, and understand that the new citizenship law is to practically deprive them of all civil rights. The only reason it hadn't become law already, Messersmith had learned, was that for the moment the men behind it feared the unfavorable public sentiment it would arouse abroad. The draft had been circulating for 9 weeks, and this prompted Messersmith to end his dispatch with a bit of wishful thinking. "The fact that the law has been under consideration for such a long time," he wrote, "may be an indication that in its final form it will be less radical than that still contemplated." Dodd reiterated his commitment to objectivity and understanding in an August 12th letter to Roosevelt, in which he wrote that while he did not approve of Germany's treatment of Jews or Hitler's drive to restore the country's military power, "fundamentally, I believe a people has a right to govern itself, and that other peoples must exercise patience, even when cruelties and injustices are done. Give men a chance to try their schemes." Chapter 10. Tiergartenstrasse, 27A. Martha and her mother set out to find the family a house to lease so that they could move out of the Esplanade, escape its opulence, in Dodd's view, and lead a more settled life. Bill Jr., meanwhile, enrolled in a doctoral program at the University of Berlin. To improve his German as speedily as possible, he arranged to live during the school week with the family of a professor. The matter of housing the U.S. ambassador in Berlin had long been an embarrassment. Some years earlier, the State Department had acquired and renovated a large and lavish building, the Blücher Palace, on Paratzerplatz, behind the Brandenburg Gate, to provide an ambassador's residence and consolidate in one location all the other diplomatic and consular offices spread throughout the city, and also to raise America's physical presence nearer to that of Britain and France, whose embassies had long been ensconced in majestic palaces on the plaza. However, just before Dodd's predecessor, Frederick Sackett, was to move in, fire had gutted the building. It had stood as a forlorn wreck ever since, forcing Sackett and now Dodd to find alternative lodging. On a personal level, Dodd was not unhappy about this, though he reviled the waste of all the money thus far expended on the palace. The government, he wrote, had paid an exorbitant price for the building, but, you know, it was in 1928 or 1929 when everybody was crazy. He liked the idea of having a home outside the embassy itself. "Personally, I would rather have my residence a half-hour's walk away than to have it in the Palais," he wrote. He acknowledged that having a building large enough to house junior officials would be a good thing, but any of us who have to see people would find that the residence alongside of our offices would deprive us practically of all privacy, which is sometimes very essential. Martha and her mother toured Greater Berlin's lovely residential neighborhoods and discovered the city to be full of parks and gardens, with planters and flowers seemingly on every balcony. In the farthest districts, they saw what appeared to be tiny farms, possibly just the thing for Martha's father. They encountered squads of uniformed young people happily marching and singing, and more threatening formations of stormtroopers with men of all sizes in ill-fitting uniforms, the centerpiece of which was a brown shirt of spectacularly unflattering cut. More rarely, they spotted the leaner, better-tailored men of the SS, in night black, accented with red, like some species of oversized blackbird. The Dodds found many properties to choose from, though at first they failed to ask themselves why so many grand old mansions were available for lease, so fully and luxuriously furnished, with ornate tables and chairs, gleaming pianos, and rare vases, maps, and books, still in place. One area they particularly liked was the district immediately south of the Tiergarten, along Dodd's route to work, where they found gardens, plentiful shade, a quiet atmosphere, and an array of handsome houses. A property in the district had become available, which they learned of through the embassy's military attaché, who had been told of its availability directly by the owner, Alfred Panofsky, the wealthy Jewish proprietor of a private bank and one of the many Jews, some 16,000, or about 9% of Berlin's Jews, who lived within the district. Even though Jews were being evicted from their jobs throughout Germany, Panofsky's bank continued in operation, and surprisingly with official indulgence. Panofsky promised the rent would be very reasonable. Dodd, by now ruing but still adhering to his vow to live within his salary, was interested, and toward the end of July went to take a look. The house at Tiergartenstrasse 27A was a four-story mansion of stone that had been built for Ferdinand Warburg of the famed Warburg dynasty. The park was across the street. Panofsky and his mother showed the Dodds the property, and now Dodd learned that, in fact, Panofsky was not offering the whole house, only the first three floors. The banker and his mother planned to occupy the top floor and reserved as well the use of the mansion's electric elevator. Panofsky was sufficiently wealthy that he did not need the income from the lease, but he had seen enough since Hitler's appointment as chancellor to know that no Jew, no matter how prominent, was safe from Nazi persecution. He offered 27A to the new ambassador with the express intention of gaining for himself and his mother an enhanced level of physical protection, calculating that surely even the stormtroopers would not risk the international outcry likely to arise from an attack on the house shared by the American ambassador. The Dodds, for their part, would gain all the amenities of a freestanding house, yet for a fraction of the cost, in a structure whose street presence was sufficiently impressive to communicate American power and prestige, and whose interior spaces were grand enough to allow the entertainment of government and diplomatic guests without embarrassment. In a letter to President Roosevelt, Dodd exulted, "We have one of the best residences in Berlin at $150 a month, due to the fact the owner is a wealthy Jew most willing to let us have it." Panofsky and Dodd signed a one-page gentleman's agreement, though Dodd still had a few qualms about the place. While he loved the quiet, the trees, the garden, and the prospect of continuing to walk to work each morning, he judged the house too opulent and called it derisively our new mansion. A plaque bearing the image of an American eagle was affixed to the iron gate at the entrance to the property, and on Saturday, August 5, 1933, Dodd and his family left the esplanade behind and moved into their new home. Dodd conceded later that if he had known Panofsky's actual intentions for the use of the fourth floor beyond simply lodging himself and his mother, he never would have agreed to the lease. Trees and gardens filled the yard, which was surrounded with a high iron fence set in a knee-high wall of brick. Anyone arriving on foot reached the front entrance through door-like gates built of vertical bars of iron. By car, through a tall master gate topped with an elaborate ironwork arch with a translucent orb at its center. The front doorway of the house was invariably in shadow and formed a black rectangle at the base of a rounded tower-like facade that rose the full height of the building. The mansion's most peculiar architectural feature was an imposing protrusion about 1.5 stories tall that jutted from the front of the house to form a porte-cochere over the entry driveway, and served as a gallery for the display of paintings. The main entrance and foyer were on the ground floor, at the rear of which lay the operational soul of the house. Servants' quarters, laundry, ice storage, various supply rooms and cupboards, a pantry and a huge kitchen, which Martha described as being twice the size of an average New York apartment. Upon entering the house, the Dodds walked first into a large vestibule flanked on both sides by cloakrooms, and then up an elaborate staircase to the main floor. It was here that the true drama of the house became evident. At the front, behind the curved facade, was a ballroom with an oval dance floor of gleaming wood and a piano covered in rich fringed fabric, its bench upholstered and gilded. Here, on the piano, the Dodds placed an elaborate vase full of tall flowers, and beside this a framed photographic portrait of Martha, in which she looked exceptionally beautiful and overtly sexual, an odd choice, perhaps, for the ballroom of an ambassadorial residence. One reception room had walls covered in dark green damask, another pink satin. A vast dining room had walls sheathed in red tapestry. The Dodds' bedroom was on the third floor. Panofsky and his mother were to live on the floor above this, the attic floor. The master bathroom was immense, so elaborate and overdone as to be comical, at least in Martha's view. Its floors and walls were entirely done in gold and colored mosaics. A large tub stood on a raised platform, like something on display in a museum. For weeks, Martha wrote, I roared with laughter whenever I saw the bathroom, and occasionally, as a lark, would take my friends up to see it when my father was away. Though the house still struck Dodd as overly luxurious, even he had to concede that its ballroom and reception rooms would come in handy for diplomatic functions, some of which he knew and dreaded would require the invitation of scores of guests so as not to offend an overlooked ambassador. And he loved the winter garden at the south end of the main floor, a glassed-in chamber that opened onto a tiled terrace overlooking the garden. Inside he would lie reading in a recliner. On fine days he sat outside in a cane chair, a book in his lap, as he caught the southern sun. The family's overall favorite room was the library, which offered the prospect of cozy winter nights beside a fire. It was walled with dark, gleaming wood and red damask, and had a great old fireplace, whose black enameled mantle was carved with forests and human figures. The shelves were full of books, many of which Dodd judged to be ancient and valuable. At certain times of day, the room was bathed in colored light cast from stained glass set high in one wall. A glass-topped table displayed valuable manuscripts and letters left there by Panofsky. Martha especially liked the library's roomy brown leather sofa, soon to become an asset in her romantic life. The size of the house, the remoteness of its bedrooms, the quiet of its fabric-sheathed walls, these too would prove valuable, as would her parents' habit of retiring early, despite the prevailing Berlin custom of staying up to all hours. On that Saturday in August, when the Dodds moved in, the Panofskys graciously placed fresh flowers throughout the house, prompting Dodd to write a thank-you note. We are convinced that, thanks to your kind efforts and thoughtfulness, we shall be very happy in your lovely house. Among the diplomatic community, the house at Tiergartenstrasse 27A quickly became known as a haven where people could speak their minds without fear. I love going there because of Dodd's brilliant mind, his sharp gift of observation and trenchantly sarcastic tongue, wrote Bella Fromm, the society columnist. I like it because there is no rigid ceremony as observed in other diplomatic houses. One regular visitor was Prince Louis Ferdinand, who in a memoir described the house as his second home. He often joined the Dodds for dinner. When the servants were out of sight, we opened our hearts, he wrote. Sometimes the prince's candor was too much even for Ambassador Dodd, who warned him, If you don't try to be more careful with your talk, Prince Louis, they will hang you one of these days. I'll come to your funeral, all right, but that won't do you much good, I am afraid. As the family settled in, Martha and her father fell into an easy camaraderie. They traded jokes and wry observations. We love each other, she wrote in a letter to Thornton Wilder, and I am told state secrets. We laugh at the Nazis and ask our sweet butler if he has Jewish blood. The butler, named Fritz, short, blonde, obsequious, efficient, had worked for Dodd's predecessor. We talk mostly politics at table, she continued. Father reads chapters of his Old South to the guests. They almost perish of chagrin and mystification. She noted that her mother, whom she called Her Excellency, was in good health, but a bit nervous and rather enjoying it all. Her father, she wrote, was flourishing incredibly and seemed slightly pro-German. She added, We sort of don't like the Jews anyway. Carl Sandburg sent her a maundering letter of greeting, typed on two very thin sheets of paper with spaces instead of punctuation marks. Now the hegira begins the Wanderjahr, the track over the sea, and the zigzag over the continent, and the center and the home in Berlin, where are many ragged arithmetics and torn testaments. Through the doors will pass all the garbs and tongues and tales of Europe. The Jews, the communists, the atheists, the non-Aryans, the proscribed, will not always come as such, but they will come in guises, disguises, disguises. Some will arrive with strange songs, and a few with lines we have known and loved. Correspondents, casual and permanent, international spies, spindrift, beachcombers, aviators, heroes. The Dodds soon learned they had a prominent and much-feared neighbor farther along Tiergartenstrasse, on a side street called Standartenstrasse. Captain Rome himself, commander of the stormtroopers. Every morning he could be seen riding a large black horse in the Tiergarten. Another nearby building, a lovely two-story mansion that housed Hitler's personal chancellery, would soon become the home of a Nazi program to euthanize people with severe mental or physical disabilities, codenamed ACTION, Action T4, for the address Tiergartenstrasse 4. To the horror of Consular Gordon, Ambassador Dodd continued his practice of walking to work, alone, unguarded, in his plain business suits. Now, Sunday, August 13, 1933, with Hindenburg still convalescing on his estate, Dodd still an unofficial ambassador, and the matter of establishing a new household at last resolved, the family, accompanied by Martha's new friend, correspondent Quentin Reynolds, set off to see a little of Germany. They traveled first by car, the Dodds' Chevrolet, but planned to separate at Leipzig, about 90 miles south of Berlin, where Dodd and his wife planned to linger a while and visit landmarks from his days at Leipzig University. Martha, Bill Jr., and Reynolds continued south, with the aim of eventually reaching Austria. Theirs would prove to be a journey laden with incidents that would provide the first challenge to Martha's rosy view of the new Germany. Part 3. Lucifer in the Garden. Chapter 11. Strange Beings. They drove south, through lovely countryside and small, neat villages, everything looking very much the same as it had 35 years earlier, when Dodd previously had passed this way, with the salient exception that in town after town the facades of public buildings were hung with banners bearing the red, white, and black insignia of the Nazi Party, with the inevitable broken cross at the center. At 11 o'clock they arrived at their first stop, the Schlosskirche, or Castle Church, in Wittenberg, where Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door and launched the Reformation. As a student, Dodd had traveled to Wittenberg from Leipzig and had sat in on services within the church. Now he found its doors locked. A Nazi parade moved through the city's streets. The group paused in Wittenberg for only an hour, then continued to Leipzig, where they arrived at 1 o'clock, and made their way directly to one of the most famous restaurants in Germany, Auerbach's Keller, a favorite haunt of Goethe, who used the restaurant as a setting for an encounter between Mephistopheles and Faust, during which Mephisto's wine turned to fire. Dodd gauged the meal excellent, especially its price, 3 marks. He drank neither wine nor beer. Martha, Bill, and Reynolds, on the other hand, consumed stein after stein. Now the party split into 2 groups. The young ones headed off by car toward Nuremberg. Dodd and his wife checked into a hotel, rested for several hours, then went out for supper, another good meal at an even better price, 2 marks. They continued touring the next day, then caught a train back to Berlin, where they arrived at 5 o'clock and took a taxi back to their new home at Tiergartenstrasse 27A. Dodd had been home little more than 24 hours when another attack occurred against an American. The victim this time was a 30-year-old surgeon named Daniel Mulvihill, who lived in Manhattan but practiced at a hospital on Long Island, and was in Berlin to study the techniques of a famed German surgeon. Messerschmitt, in a dispatch on the incident, said Mulvihill was an American citizen of a fine type, and is not a Jew. The attack followed a pattern that would become all too familiar. On the evening of Tuesday, August 15th, Mulvihill was walking along Unter den Linden on his way to a drugstore when he stopped to watch the approach of a parade of uniformed SA members. The stormtroopers were reenacting for a propaganda film the Great March through the Brandenburg Gate that took place on the night of Hitler's appointment as Chancellor. Mulvihill looked on, unaware that one SA man had left the parade and was headed his way. The trooper, without preamble, struck Mulvihill hard on the left side of his head, then calmly rejoined the parade. Bystanders told the stunned surgeon that the assault likely had occurred because of Mulvihill's failure to offer the Hitler salute as the parade passed. This was the 12th violent attack on an American since March 4th. The U.S. consulate immediately protested, and by Friday evening the Gestapo claimed to have arrested the assailant. The next day, Saturday, August 19th, a senior government official notified Vice Consul Raymond Geist that an order had been issued to the SA and SS stating that foreigners were not expected to give or return the Hitler salute. The official also said that the head of the Berlin division of the SA, a young officer named Karl Ernst, would personally call on Dodd early the next week to apologize for the incident. Consul General Messerschmitt, who had met Ernst before, wrote that he was very young, very energetic, direct, enthusiastic, but exuded an atmosphere of brutality and force which is characteristic of the SA. Ernst arrived as promised. He clicked his heels and saluted and barked, "Heil Hitler!" Dodd acknowledged the salute but did not return it. He listened to Ernst's confessions of regret and heard him promise that no such attack would occur again. Ernst appeared to think he had done all he needed to do, but Dodd now sat him down and, lapsing into his familiar roles as both father and professor, gave Ernst a severe lecture on the bad behavior of his men and its potential consequences. Ernst, discomfited, insisted that he really did intend to try to stop the attacks. He then rose, snapped to rigid attention, saluted again, made a Prussian bow, and left. "I was not a little amused," Dodd wrote. That afternoon he told Messerschmitt that Ernst had delivered an appropriate apology. Messerschmitt said, "The incidents will go on." All along the route to Nuremberg, Martha and her companions encountered groups of men in the brown uniform of the SA, young and old, fat and skinny, parading and singing and holding Nazi banners aloft. Often, as the car slowed to pass through narrow village streets, onlookers turned toward them and made the Hitler salute, shouting, "Heil Hitler!" apparently interpreting the low number on the license plate, traditionally America's ambassador to Germany had number 13, as proof that those within must be the family of some senior Nazi official from Berlin. The excitement of the people was contagious, and I heiled as vigorously as any Nazi, Martha wrote in her memoir. Her behavior dismayed her brother and Reynolds, but she ignored their sarcastic jibes. I felt like a child, ebullient and careless, the intoxication of the new regime working like wine in me. At about midnight, they pulled to a stop in front of their hotel in Nuremberg. Reynolds had been to Nuremberg before and knew it to be a sleepy place this late at night, but now, he wrote, they found the street filled with an excited, happy crowd. His first thought was that these revelers were participants in a festival of the city's legendary toy industry. Inside the hotel, Reynolds asked the registration clerk, "Is there going to be a parade?" The clerk, cheerful and pleasant, laughed with such delight that the tips of his mustache shook, Reynolds recalled. "It will be a kind of a parade," the clerk said. "They are teaching someone a lesson." The three took their bags to their rooms, then set out for a walk to see the city and find something to eat. The crowd outside had grown larger and was infused with good cheer. Everyone was keyed up, laughing, talking, Reynolds saw. What struck him was how friendly everyone was, far more friendly, certainly, than an equivalent crowd of Berliners would have been. Here, he noted, if you bumped into someone by accident, you got a polite smile and cheerful forgiveness. From a distance they heard the coarse, intensifying clamor of a still larger and more raucous crowd approaching on the street. They heard distant music, a street band, all brass and noise. The crowd pressed inward in happy anticipation, Reynolds wrote. We could hear the roar of the crowd 3 blocks away, a laughing roar that swelled toward us with the music. The noise grew, accompanied by a shimmery tangerine glow that fluttered on the facades of the buildings. Moments later, the marchers came into view, a column of SA men in brown uniforms carrying torches and banners. Stormtroopers, Reynolds noted, not doll makers. Immediately behind the first squad, there followed 2 very large troopers, and between them a much smaller human captive, though Reynolds could not at first tell whether it was a man or a woman. The troopers were half-supporting, half-dragging the figure along the street. Its head had been clipped bald, Reynolds wrote, and face and head had been coated with white powder. Martha described the face as having the color of diluted absinthe. They edged closer, as did the crowd around them, and now Reynolds and Martha saw that the figure was a young woman, though Reynolds still was not completely certain. Even though the figure wore a skirt, it might have been a man dressed as a clown, Reynolds wrote. The crowd around me roared at the spectacle of this figure being dragged along. The genial Nurembergers around them became transformed and taunted and insulted the woman. The troopers at her sides abruptly lifted her to her full height, revealing a placard hung around her neck. Coarse laughter rose from all around. Martha, Bill, and Reynolds deployed their halting German to ask other bystanders what was happening, and learned in fragments that the girl had been associating with a Jewish man. As best Martha could garner, the placard said, "I have offered myself to a Jew." As the stormtroopers went past, the crowd surged from the sidewalks into the street behind and followed. A 2-decker bus became stranded in the mass of people. Its driver held up his hands in mock surrender. Passengers on the top deck pointed at the girl and laughed. The troopers again lifted the girl, their toy, as Reynolds put it, so that the riders could have a better view. Then someone got the idea of marching the thing into the lobby of our hotel, Reynolds wrote. He learned that the thing had a name, Anna Roth. The band stayed out on the street, where it continued to play in a loud, caustic manner. The stormtroopers emerged from the lobby and dragged the woman away toward another hotel. The band struck up the Horstfessel song, and suddenly in all directions along the street the crowd came to attention, right arms extended in the Hitler salute, all singing with vigor. When the song ended, the procession moved on. "I wanted to follow," Martha wrote, "but my 2 companions were so repelled that they pulled me away." She, too, had been shaken by the episode, but she did not let it tarnish her overall view of the country and the revival of spirit caused by the Nazi revolution. "I tried in a self-conscious way to justify the action of the Nazis, to insist that we should not condemn without knowing the whole story." The 3 retreated to the bar of their hotel, Reynolds vowing to get savagely drunk. He asked the bartender quietly about what had just occurred. The bartender told the story in a whisper. In defiance of Nazi warnings against marriage between Jews and Aryans, the young woman had planned to marry her Jewish fiancé. This would have been risky anywhere in Germany, he explained, but nowhere more so than in Nuremberg. "You have heard of Herr S., whose home is here?" the bartender said. Reynolds understood. The bartender was referring to Julius Streicher, whom Reynolds described as Hitler's circus master of anti-Semitism. Streicher, according to Hitler biographer Ian Kershaw, was a short, squat, shaven-headed bully, utterly possessed by demonic images of Jews. He had founded the virulently anti-Semitic newspaper Der Stürmer. Reynolds recognized that what he, Martha, and Bill had just witnessed was an event that had far more significance than its particular details. Foreign correspondents in Germany had reported on abuses of Jews, but so far their stories had been based on after-the-fact investigation that relied on the accounts of witnesses. Here was an act of anti-Jewish brutality that a correspondent had witnessed firsthand. The Nazis had all along been denying the atrocities that were occasionally reported abroad, but here was concrete evidence, Reynolds wrote. No other correspondent, he claimed, had witnessed any atrocities. His editor agreed it was an important story, but feared that if Reynolds tried to send it by cable, it would be intercepted by Nazi censors. He told Reynolds to send it by mail, and recommended that he omit any reference to the Dodd children in order to avoid causing difficulties for the new ambassador. Martha begged him not to write the story at all. It was an isolated case, she argued. It was not really important, would create a bad impression, did not reveal actually what was going on in Germany, overshadowed the constructive work they were doing. Martha, Bill, and Reynolds continued south into Austria, where they spent another week before returning to Germany and making their way back along the Rhine. When Reynolds returned to his office, he found an urgent summons from Foreign Press Chief Ernst Hanfsteingl. Hanfsteingl was furious, unaware as yet that Martha and Bill also had witnessed the incident. "There isn't one damned word of truth in your story," he raged. "I've talked with our people in Nuremberg, and they say nothing of the sort happened there." Reynolds quietly informed Hanfsteingl that he had watched the parade in the company of two important witnesses whom he had omitted from the story, but whose testimony was unassailable. Reynolds named them. Hanfsteingl sank into his chair and held his head. He complained that Reynolds should have told him sooner. Reynolds invited him to call the Dodds to confirm their presence, but Hanfsteingl waved away the suggestion. At a press conference soon afterward, Goebbels, the propaganda minister, did not wait for a reporter to raise the issue of abuse against Jews, but did so himself. He assured the 40 or so reporters in the room that such incidents were rare, committed by irresponsible men. One correspondent, Norman Ebbett, chief of the London Times's bureau in Berlin, interrupted, "But, Herr Minister, you must surely have heard of the Aryan girl Anna Roth, who was paraded through Nuremberg just for wanting to marry a Jew." Goebbels smiled. It utterly transformed his face, though the result was neither pleasant nor engaging. Many in the room had encountered this effect before. There was something freakish about the extent to which the muscles of the bottom half of his face became engaged in the production of his smile, and how abruptly his expressions could shift. "Let me explain how such a thing might occasionally happen," Goebbels said. "All during the 12 years of the Weimar Republic, our people were virtually in jail. Now our party is in charge, and they are free again. When a man has been in jail for 12 years, and he is suddenly freed, in his joy he may do something irrational, perhaps even brutal. Is that not a possibility in your country also?" Ebbett, his voice even, noted a fundamental difference in how England might approach such a scenario. "If it should happen," he said, "we would throw the man right back in jail." Goebbels's smile disappeared, then just as quickly returned. He looked around the room. "Are there any more questions?" The United States made no formal protest of the incident. Nonetheless, an official of the German Foreign Office apologized to Martha. He dismissed the incident as isolated, and one that would be severely punished. Martha was inclined to accept his view. She remained enthralled with life in the new Germany. In a letter to Thornton Wilder, she gushed, "The youth are bright-faced and hopeful. They sing to the noble ghost of Horst Wessel with shining eyes and unerring tongues. Wholesome and beautiful lads, these Germans. Good, sincere, healthy, mystic, brutal, fine, hopeful, capable of death and love, deep, rich, wondrous, and strange beings. These youths of modern Hockenkreuz Germany." In the meantime, Dodd received an invitation from the German Foreign Office to attend the upcoming party rally in Nuremberg, set to begin in earnest on September 1st. The invitation troubled him. He had read of the Nazi Party's penchant for staging these elaborate displays of party force and energy, and saw them not as official events sponsored by the state, but as party affairs that had nothing to do with international relations. He could not imagine himself attending such a rally any more than he could envision the German ambassador to America attending a Republican or Democratic convention. Moreover, he feared that Goebbels and his propaganda ministry would seize on the fact of his attendance and portray it as an endorsement of Nazi policies and behavior. On Tuesday, August 22nd, Dodd cabled the State Department to ask for advice. "I received a non-committal reply," he wrote in his diary. The department promised to support whatever decision he made. "I at once made up my mind not to go, even if all the other ambassadors went." The following Saturday, he notified the German Foreign Office that he would not be attending. "I declined it on the grounds of pressure of work, though the main reason was my disapproval of a government invitation to a party convention," he wrote. "I was also sure the behavior of the dominant group would be embarrassing." An idea occurred to Dodd. If he could persuade his fellow ambassadors from Britain, Spain, and France also to rebuff the invitation, their mutual action would send a potent yet suitably indirect message of unity and disapproval. Dodd first met with the Spanish ambassador, a session that Dodd described as very pleasantly unconventional, because the Spaniard likewise had not yet been accredited. Even so, both approached the issue with caution. "I implied that I would not go," Dodd wrote. He provided the Spanish ambassador with a couple of historical precedents for snubbing such an invitation. The Spanish ambassador agreed that the rally was a party affair and not a state event, but did not reveal what he planned to do. Dodd learned, however, that he did at last send his regrets, as did the ambassadors from France and Britain, each citing an inescapable commitment of one kind or another. Officially, the State Department endorsed Dodd's demurral. Unofficially, his decision rankled a number of senior officers, including Undersecretary Phillips and Western European Affairs Chief J. Pierpont Moffat. They viewed Dodd's decision as needlessly provocative, further proof that his appointment as ambassador had been a mistake. Forces opposed to Dodd began to coalesce. Chapter 12. Brutus. In late August, President Hindenburg at last returned to Berlin from his convalescence at his country estate, and so on Wednesday, August 30th, 1933, Dodd put on a formal grasshopper cutaway and top hat and drove to the presidential palace to present his credentials. The president was tall and broad, with a huge gray-white mustache that curled into two feathery wings. The collar of his uniform was high and stiff, his tunic riveted with medals, several of which were gleaming starbursts the size of Christmas tree ornaments. Overall, he conveyed a sense of strength and virility that belied his 85 years. Hitler was absent, as were Goebbels and Goering, all presumably engaged in preparing for the party rally to begin 2 days later. Dodd read a brief statement that emphasized his sympathy for the people of Germany and the nation's history and culture. He omitted any reference to the government, and in so doing hoped to telegraph that he had no such sympathy for the Hitler regime. For the next 15 minutes he and the old gentleman sat together on the preferred couch and conversed on an array of topics, ranging from Dodd's university experience in Leipzig to the dangers of economic nationalism. Hindenburg, Dodd noted later in his diary, stressed the subject of international relations so pointedly that I thought he meant indirect criticism of the Nazi extremists. Dodd introduced his key embassy officers, and then all marched from the building to find soldiers of the regular army, the Reichswehr, lining both sides of the street. This time Dodd did not walk home. As the embassy cars drove off, the soldiers stood at attention. "It was all over," Dodd wrote, "and I was at last a duly accepted representative of the United States in Berlin." 2 days later, he found himself confronting his first official crisis. On the morning of September 1st, 1933, a Friday, H.V. Kaltenborn, the American radio commentator, telephoned Consul General Messersmith to express regret that he could not stop by for one more visit, as he and his family had finished their European tour and were preparing to head back home. The train to their ship was scheduled to depart at midnight. He told Messersmith that he still had seen nothing to verify the consul's criticisms of Germany and accused him of really doing wrong in not presenting the picture in Germany as it really was. Soon after making the call, Kaltenborn and his family, wife, son, and daughter, left their hotel, the Adlon, to do a little last-minute shopping. The son, Rolf, was 16 at the time. Mrs. Kaltenborn particularly wanted to visit the jewelry stores and silver shops on Unter den Linden, but their venture also took them 7 blocks farther south to Leipziger Straße, a busy east-west boulevard jammed with cars and trams and lined with handsome buildings and myriad small shops selling bronzes, Dresden china, silks, leather goods, and just about anything else one could desire. Here, too, was the famous Wertheim's Emporium, an enormous department store, a Warenhaus, in which throngs of customers traveled from floor to floor aboard 83 elevators. As the family emerged from a shop, they saw a formation of stormtroopers was parading along the boulevard in their direction. The time was 9:20 a.m. Pedestrians crowded to the edge of the sidewalk and offered the Hitler salute. Despite his sympathetic outlook, Kaltenborn did not wish to join in, and knew that one of Hitler's top deputies, Rudolf Hess, had made a public announcement that foreigners were not obligated to do so. "This is no more to be expected," Hess had declared, "than that a Protestant cross himself when he enters a Catholic church." Nonetheless, Kaltenborn instructed his family to turn toward a shop window, as if inspecting the goods on display. Several troopers marched up to the Kaltenborns and demanded to know why they had their backs to the parade and why they did not salute. Kaltenborn, in flawless German, answered that he was an American and that he and his family were on their way back to their hotel. The crowd began insulting Kaltenborn and became threatening, to the point where the commentator called out to 2 policemen standing 10 feet away. The officers did not respond. Kaltenborn and his family began walking back toward their hotel. A young man came from behind and without a word grabbed Kaltenborn's son and struck him in the face hard enough to knock him to the sidewalk. Still, the police did nothing. One officer smiled. Furious now, Kaltenborn grabbed the young assailant by the arm and marched him toward the policeman. The crowd grew more menacing. Kaltenborn realized that if he persisted in trying to get justice, he risked further attack. At last, an onlooker interceded and persuaded the crowd to leave the Kaltenborns alone, as they clearly were American. The parade moved on. After reaching the safety of the Adlon, Kaltenborn called Messersmith. He was upset and nearly incoherent. He asked Messersmith to come to the Adlon right away. For Messersmith, it was a troubling but darkly sublime moment. He told Kaltenborn he could not come to the hotel. "It just so happened that I had to be at my desk for the next hour or so," he recalled. He did, however, dispatch to the Adlon Vice Consul Raymond Geist, who arranged that the Kaltenborns would be escorted to the station that night. It was ironical that this was just one of the things which Kaltenborn said could not happen, Messersmith wrote later, with clear satisfaction. One of the things that he specifically said I was incorrectly reporting on was that the police did not do anything to protect people against attacks. Messersmith acknowledged that the incident must have been a wrenching experience for the Kaltenborns, especially their son. It was on the whole, however, a good thing that this happened, because if it hadn't been for this incident, Kaltenborn would have gone back and told his radio audience how fine everything was in Germany and how badly the American officials were reporting to our government and how incorrectly the correspondents in Berlin were picturing developments in the country. Messersmith met with Dodd and asked whether the time had come for the State Department to issue a definitive warning against travel in Germany. Such a warning, both men knew, would have a devastating effect on Nazi prestige. Dodd favored restraint. From the perspective of his role as ambassador, he found these attacks more nuisance than dire emergency and, in fact, tried whenever possible to limit press attention. He claimed in his diary that he had managed to keep several attacks against Americans out of the newspapers altogether and had otherwise tried to prevent unfriendly demonstrations. On a personal level, however, Dodd found such episodes repugnant, utterly alien to what his experience as a student in Leipzig had led him to expect. During family meals, he condemned the attacks, but if he hoped for a sympathetic expression of outrage from his daughter, he failed to get it. Martha remained inclined to think the best of the new Germany, partly, as she conceded later, out of the simple perverseness of a daughter trying to define herself. I was trying to find excuses for their excesses, and my father would look at me a bit stonily, if tolerantly, and both in private and in public gently label me a young Nazi, she wrote. That put me on the defensive for some time, and I became temporarily an ardent defender of everything going on. She countered that there was so much else that was good about Germany. In particular, she praised the enthusiasm of the country's young people and the measures Hitler was taking to reduce unemployment. I felt there was something noble in the fresh, vigorous, strong young faces I saw everywhere, and would say so combatively every chance I got. In letters back to America, she proclaimed that Germany was undergoing a thrilling rebirth, and that the press reports and atrocity stories were isolated examples exaggerated by bitter, closed-minded people. The same Friday that had begun so tumultuously with the attack on the Kaltenborns ended for Dodd in a far more satisfactory manner. That evening, correspondent Edgar Maurer set out for Zoo Station to begin his long journey to Tokyo. His wife and daughter accompanied him to the station, but only to see him off. They were to stay behind to oversee the packing of the family's household goods, and would follow soon afterward. Most of the foreign correspondents in the city converged on the station, as did a few stalwart Germans, daring enough to let themselves be seen and identified by the agents who still kept Maurer under surveillance. A Nazi official assigned to make sure Maurer actually got on the train came up to him and in a wheedling voice asked, "And when are you coming back to Germany, Herr Maurer?" With cinematic flair, Maurer answered, "Why, when I can come back with about 2 million of my countrymen." Messerschmitt embraced him in a display of support intended for the agents keeping watch. In a voice loud enough to be overheard, Messerschmitt promised that Maurer's wife and daughter would follow unmolested. Maurer was appreciative, but had not forgiven Messerschmitt for failing to support his bid to stay in Germany. As Maurer climbed aboard the train, he turned to Messerschmitt with a slight smile and said, "And you too, Brutus." For Messerschmitt, it was a crushing remark. "I felt miserable and depressed," he wrote. "I knew it was the thing for him to do, to leave, and yet I hated the part that I had played in his leaving." Dodd did not appear. He was glad Maurer was gone. In a letter to a friend in Chicago, he wrote that Maurer was for a time, as you may know, somewhat of a problem here. Dodd conceded that Maurer was a talented writer. His experiences, however, after the publication of his book, his notoriety and a Pulitzer Prize, were such that he became rather more sharp and irritable than was best for all parties concerned. Maurer and his family made it safely to Tokyo. His wife Lillian recalled her great sorrow at having to leave Berlin. "Nowhere have I had such lovely friends as in Germany," she wrote. "Looking back on it all is like seeing someone you love go mad and do horrible things." The demands of protocol, in German Protokoll, descended over Dodd's days like a black fog, and kept him from the thing he loved most, his old South. With his status as ambassador now official, his routine diplomatic responsibility suddenly swelled to a degree that caused him dismay. In a letter to Secretary of State Hull, he wrote, The protocol arbiters of one's social behavior follow precedent and commit one to entertainments the early part of one's residence which are substantially useless, and which give every one of the various embassies and ministries the social right to offer grand dinners. It started almost immediately. Protocol required that he give a reception for the entire diplomatic corps. He expected 40 to 50 guests, but then learned that each diplomat planned to bring one or more members of his staff, causing the eventual attendance to rise to over 200. So today the show began at 5 o'clock, Dodd wrote in his diary. The embassy rooms had been prepared, flowers abounded everywhere, a great punch bowl was filled with the accustomed liquors. Foreign Minister Neurath came, as did Reichsbank President Schacht, one of the few other men in Hitler's government whom Dodd saw as reasonable and rational. Schacht would become a frequent visitor to the Dodds' home, well-liked by Mrs. Dodd, who often used him to avoid the awkward social moments that occurred when an expected guest suddenly canceled. She was fond of saying, "Well, if at the last minute another guest can't come, we can always invite Dr. Schacht." Overall, Dodd decided it was not a bad affair, and, a point of special satisfaction, cost 700 marks. But now a flood of return invitations, both diplomatic and social, arrived on Dodd's desk and at his home. Depending on the importance of the event, these were often followed by an exchange of seating charts, given to protocol officers to ensure that no unfortunate error of propinquity would mar the evening. The number of supposedly must-go banquets and receptions reached a point where even veteran diplomats complained that attendance had become onerous and exhausting. A senior official in the German Foreign Office said to Dodd, "You people in the diplomatic corps will have to limit social doings, or we shall have to quit accepting invitations." And a British official complained, "We simply cannot stand the pace." It was not all drudgery, of course. These parties and banquets yielded moments of fun and humor. Goebbels was known for his wit. Martha, for a time, considered him charming. Infectious and delightful, eyes sparkling, voice soft, his speech witty and light. It is difficult to remember his cruelty, his cunning, destructive talents. Her mother, Mattie, always enjoyed being seated next to Goebbels at banquets. Dodd considered him one of the few men with a sense of humor in Germany, and often engaged him in a brisk repartee of quips and ironic comment. An extraordinary newspaper photograph shows Dodd, Goebbels, and Sigrid Schultz at a formal banquet during a moment of what appears to be animated, carefree bonhomie. Though doubtless useful for Nazi propaganda, the scene as played out in the banquet hall was rather more complex than was captured on film. In fact, as Schultz later explained in an oral history interview, she was trying not to speak to Goebbels, but in the process certainly looked flirtatious. She explained, deploying the third person, "In this picture, Sigrid won't give him the time of day, you see. He's turning on 1,000 watts of charm, but he knows, and she knows, that she has no use for him." When Dodd saw the resulting photograph, she said, "He laughed his head off." Göring, too, seemed a relatively benign character, at least as compared with Hitler. Sigrid Schultz found him the most tolerable of the senior Nazis, because at least you felt you could be in the same room with the man, whereas Hitler, she said, kind of turned my stomach. One of the American Embassy's officers, John C. White, said years later, "I was always rather favorably impressed by Göring. If any Nazi was likable, I suppose he came nearest to it." At this early stage, diplomats and others found Göring hard to take seriously. He was like an immense, if exceedingly dangerous, little boy who delighted in creating and wearing new uniforms. His great size made him the brunt of jokes, although such jokes were told only well out of his hearing. One night, Ambassador Dodd and his wife went to a concert at the Italian embassy, which Göring also attended. In a vast white uniform of his own design, he looked especially huge, three times the size of an ordinary man, as daughter Martha told the story. The chairs set out for the concert were tiny gilded antiques that seemed far too fragile for Goering. With fascination and no small degree of anxiety, Mrs. Dodd watched Goering choose the chair directly in front of hers. She immediately found herself transfixed as Goering attempted to fit his gigantic heart-shaped rump onto the little chair. Throughout the concert, she feared that at any moment the chair would collapse and Goering's great bulk would come crashing into her lap. Martha wrote, "She was so distracted at the sight of the huge loins rolling off the sides and edges of the chair, so perilously near to her, she couldn't remember a single piece that was played." Dodd's biggest complaint about the diplomatic parties thrown by other embassies was how much money was wasted in the process, even by those countries laid low by the Depression. To illustrate, he wrote to Secretary Hull, "Last night we went at 8:30 to dine at the 53-room house of the Belgian minister, whose country is supposed to be unable to meet its lawful obligations." Two servants in uniform met his car. Four lackeys stood on the stairways, dressed in the style of Louis XIV servants. Three other servants in knee breeches took charge of our wraps. 29 people sat down in a more expensively furnished dining room than any room in the White House that I have seen. 8 courses were served by 4 uniformed waiters on silver dishes and platters. There were 3 wine glasses at every plate, and when we rose, I noticed that many glasses were half full of wine which was to be wasted. The people at the party were agreeable enough, but there was no conversation of any value at all at my part of the table. This I have noted at all other large parties. Nor was there any serious, informative, or even witty talk after dinner. Martha attended as well and described how all the women were covered with diamonds or other precious stones. I had never seen such a lavish display of wealth. She noted also that she and her parents left at 10:30, and in so doing caused a minor scandal. There was a good deal of genteel raising of eyebrows, but we braved the storm and went home. It was bad form, she discovered later, to leave a diplomatic function before 11. Dodd was shocked to learn that his independently wealthy predecessors in Berlin had spent up to $100,000 a year on entertaining, more than 5 times Dodd's total salary. On some occasions they had tipped their servants more than what Dodd paid in rent each month. But, he vowed to Hull, "We shall not return these hospitalities in larger than 10 or 12 guest parties, with 4 servants at most, and they modestly clad," meaning presumably that they would be fully clothed, but forego the knee breeches of the Belgians. The Dodds kept 3 servants, had a chauffeur, and hired an extra servant or two for parties attended by more than 10 guests. The embassy's cupboard, according to a formal inventory of government-owned property made for its annual post-report, contained dinner plates, 10.5 inches, 4 dozen, soup plates, 9.5 inches, 2 dozen, entree plates, 9.5 inches, 2 dozen, dessert plates, 2 dozen, salad plates, 5 5/16 inches, 2 dozen, bread and butter plates, 6 3/16 inches, 2 dozen, teacups, 3.5 inches, 2 dozen, saucers, 5 11/16 inches, 2 dozen, bouillon cups, 3.5 inches, 2 dozen, saucers, 5 11/16 inches, 2 dozen, after-dinner cups, 2.5 inches, 2 dozen, saucers, 4 3/4 inches, 2 dozen, chop dishes, 2 dozen, platters, various sizes, 4 dozen, goblets, 3 dozen, tall sherbet, 3 dozen, low sherbet, 3 dozen, small tumblers, 3 dozen, tall tumblers, 3 dozen, finger bowls, 3 dozen, finger bowl plates, 3 dozen. We shall not use silver platters, nor floods of wines, nor will there be card tables all about the place, Dodd told Hull. There will always be an effort to have some scholar or scientist or literary person present, and some informatory talk. and it is understood that we retire at 10:30 to 11. We make no advertisement of these things, but it is known that we shall not remain here when we find that we cannot make both ends meet on the salary allowed. In a letter to Carl Sandburg, he wrote, "I can never adapt myself